Okay, so I was asked to talk about this subject. There's actually been quite a lot of work recently, a lot of articles published in the last year, and kind of brings to resolves a number of longstanding issues and confusion over Higgs production with B quarks. As mentioned, very recent, in fact, still preliminary work from the gluon fusion production. There's the use of BB bar annihilation to produce Higgs at next to leading order, next to next to leading order, as well as associated production and Susie corrections. Oh, and why is there so much interest? It's all because of supersymmetry. First, give a recap. In the standard model, there's a single Higgs doublet, breaks electric symmetry breaking, leaving behind one Higgs boson. The couplings are just directly proportional to the masses of the particles, the masses that they give to the particles. And so the production modes are dominated by the massive particles. Gluon fusion through a virtual top loop, weak boson fusion with quarks radiate, W's and Z's, which recombine, or open top production with radiation of a Higgs boson. You can see here that these are the most important modes. Gluon fusion dominating by an order of magnitude over most of the Higgs mass range. This is the weak boson fusion component here. The top production is important for the low mass discovery reach, though it's not one of the largest production modes. It's an identifiable mode is what makes it such an important component. been a lot of work on standard model production recently, which I'll just sum up very briefly. Using an effective Lagrangian technique, you can turn these difficult, this diagram is not so difficult, but the radiative corrections to it are quite difficult. Next to leading order calculations have been done in the Folk theory. Using this, one can do next to next to leading order calculations, and those have been done recently. And you find that for this process, the radiative corrections are very important, and they're important because they're huge. The NLO correction was 70 to 100%. next to leading order correction using the effective theory is still not small, 10 to 15%, but much better behaved and gives a nice satisfying result that perturbation theory is indeed under control. In supersymmetric Higgs boson production, everything is different. First, there are two Higgs doublets, each with their own vacuum expectation values. And after symmetry breaking, there are five physical scalars. the light Higgs, the heavy Higgs scalars, the pseudoscalar, and the charged pair. Now, in the decoupling limit, this light scalar behaves very much like a standard model Higgs. But the heavy Higgs and the pseudoscalar have very different couplings. And if you go away from the decoupling regime, all of the neutral scalars have very different couplings and behaviors from the standard model. just as a framework to work in, I'll assume the decoupling limit, and therefore I can treat the heavy Higgs and the pseudoscalar in a very similar fashion. Now, the pseudoscalar production also can be done with heavy top loops, are the most important, well, at small tan beta, they are the most important contribution. But you can use an effective theory in much the same way, and you can again do next to next to leading order corrections. The behavior is very similar for the standard model Higgs. The next to leading order corrections were enormous, and the next to next to leading order corrections are much better behaved and have a much better, much reduced theoretical uncertainty. So, been a lot of work on Susie Higgs production. The full massive diagrams have been computed at next to leading order. NLO corrections to pseudoscalar production have been performed in the heavy top limit. And there have also been work on including supersymmetric corrections to this production. Now, all these, so the processes I've talked about so far are dominated by the heavy top limit. But this is only really applies when tan beta is relatively small. And the reason for that is that the coupling, relative couplings of the top quark and the bottom quark to the Higgs is scales with tangent beta. That is, the down type quarks, B quark, is enhanced by a factor of tan beta, and the top quark is coupling is suppressed by a factor of tan beta. So if tan beta is not very close to 1, the B quark becomes important. Now, you could just go back and try to beat on the gluon fusion mechanism, and to do that, honestly, requires a full 3-loop massive calculation of the B quark loops, which, in spite of, as Hans was talking about, there's progress being made on doing massive multi-loop diagrams, but that's still a ways off. And you can't use these effective Lagrangian techniques to use a B quark to produce a very heavy particle. But this importance of the B quark suggests a new production mode, where instead of having just a B loop, you actually have open B production and radiating the Higgs off of the B. And the parent process for this is gluon annihilation producing BB bar and radiating a Higgs. And this process can dominate at large tan beta. And the reason it does this is because the cross-section is suppressed by the ratio of the masses, the B mass to the Higgs mass, but it's enhanced by the tan beta squared. Whereas the gluon fusion cross-section, this is the top loop. It's actually suppressed by tan beta squared. This is the interference term, which the tan beta dependence cancels. And it's only this term. I've left off exponents. This is mb squared over mh squared. This is mb to the fourth over mh to the fourth. So it's doubly suppressed to get before it gets the tan beta enhancement. And it's not going to catch up to this. I'll show plots which show that for not terribly large tan beta of order 7, this process dominates Higgs production, or the heavy and the pseudoscalar Higgs production. Now, in computing this process, the question arises whether one should use a fixed flavor number scheme or a variable flavor number scheme. Okay? So a fixed flavor number scheme has, say, 3 active flavors, or 4, if we're talking about using the B quark, but the B quark would not be an active flavor. And heavy flavor, like the B, is only produced through explicit gluon splitting within the Feynman diagrams. Now, while this is a well-defined process, it seems rather forced. For instance, you wouldn't use it in every application. If you're interested in jet production, it makes no sense to treat the B as massive when you're actually producing 200 GeV jets. Nonetheless, it is often used near the flavor threshold. A full variable flavor number scheme recognizes these thresholds and simply changes the number of active flavors as you cross this threshold. Right, we're all familiar with this, with the Collins-Wolchek Z prescription for the running of alpha S, where below the mass threshold, or below the charm threshold, you have alpha S runs with 3 flavors. At the charm threshold, it picks up a 4th flavor. Now, the exact point at which this matching is performed is somewhat arbitrary. It's usually chosen to be the MS bar mass, because that way you avoid having to carry along extra logarithms. There's also a switching scale where you decide to actually start using this other definition of alpha S, and it doesn't have to match. You can extend that significantly above the matching scale. It's because both near the matching scale, both prescriptions are valid, and it's within the uncertainty of your order of calculation as to which one you want to use. Almost no one strictly adheres to a fixed flavor number scheme. All right, what you really do when you say you're working in a fixed flavor scheme is you're just putting off the switching scale above the scale you want to work at. Okay, it's because, as I say, if you're looking at 500 GeV jets, you don't care about the mass of the light quarks of the B or the charm. Now, so far I haven't addressed parton distributions. You can extend this scheme to include the parton distributions. All you have to do is, say, below the production threshold, you simply define the part-time distribution to be zero. Some people that even have intrinsic charm or intrinsic bottom and define it below the scale. But I'm not going to talk about that. That's that requires a careful definition of what the proton is. But at the production threshold, you start allowing the gluons to split into the heavy flavor. And then above threshold, the evolution is governed by the renormalization group equation, which is just the Altieri-Parisi equation. Okay. As for alpha S, there's a matching scale and a switching scale, and they don't have to coincide, though they can be made to. And everything is consistent. Okay. Now, in the process we're interested in, you get logarithmic corrections if you want to look at inclusive Higgs production, where you're going to integrate over the Bs and not detect them. You're going to get collinear logarithms when a gluon emits an on-shell B in the forward direction. You integrate over those directions, you're going to get collinear logarithms. Now, in a variable flavor number scheme, you actually would use B partons, and so you would define your lowest order contribution to be just this annihilation diagram, and a real correction would include this diagram here. This would be a double real correction. Okay, so, let me go back. These logarithms that are developed here are accounted for in the Altieri-Parisi evolution of the B parton distribution. Okay, they're not just accounted for, but they're resummed. In this calculation, they're going to come in order by order. You're going to develop these logarithms. In this picture, they're built in for you to all orders through the evolution of the parton distribution. Now, there's many motivations for separating the switching scale. One is you might want continuity. You don't want a kink in your graph because you've switched scale in the middle of, you measure a physical process. It's not going to have a kink because it switches scale. But your calculation might if you change scale halfway through your plot. Another way is that you might worry that this transition, especially this gluon splitting, is a crude hack. That's one way people have characterized it. But it doesn't have to be. You can include all the full kinematics of the massive part of the mass effects of the gluon splitting into the calculation. In fact, both MRST and CTEC do this in some of their parton distribution sets. They put in threshold information. It's not just that you have to pretend that the quark is massless. Right? In fact, the renormalization group equation, the Altieri-Parisi equation, is mass independent. It doesn't care about the mass. So you put in the mass information at threshold, it will, if you evolve to high scale, that just washes out. That's a power suppressed effect. It's not when you go to high scale, it's not that you've ignored the mass, it's that the renormalization group equation didn't depend on the mass. Okay? Now, you can use things like F2 charm to help fit for a charm distribution, but it turns out that in fact these heavy quark PDFs are completely dominated by the gluon fit. There's not enough data to produce an F2B, so the B quark is just radiation of the gluon or splitting of the gluons. So this is the CTEC heavy quark, CTEC 6 heavy quark fit. Compared to F2C. Now, there is no x-axis because they've combined the x-axis various x and q squared bins, but they just compare it to the theory. And though you can look at other plots and see that it is pretty much proportional to the gluon density, you get pretty good agreement to F2C just from this process. So it's a perfectly reasonable process. This is done starting near threshold. You don't have to ignore the kinematics. You don't have to pretend that you don't have a charm distribution right near threshold. Everything works consistently. Okay? Now, one thing people worried about with this BB bar annihilation is that it seemed to give a very different result from the gluon fusion component. This is the nominal scale choice, at the Higgs mass. So mu zero is mh over 2. So 2 is the nominal scale. And you see that there's a very large difference between the two calculations. Okay? Now, I would say that that complaint is a red herring, because both of these calculations have huge scale dependence, and neither one is reliable. And the fact that they don't agree doesn't mean very much. You can't believe either one of them. They're just too unreliable. Okay. A more sophisticated complaint is that the LHC is just not high enough energy to see to develop a full factorization of the B quark. The idea is that proper factorization requires that this collinear enhanced term scale like PT over the M times M plus PT squared. And they say that, well, you know, it works pretty good at low PT, but it begins to fall off pretty badly, and it does so well below the Higgs mass, which is out here. Okay? So they're saying it's just not properly factorized. Therefore, it's unreliable, and you can't and should not be used. Well, you can spin this a very, very different way, and that is to say, well, the framework is very solid. We haven't made any wild approximations. It all follows very logically. This is the way to resum the logs. This is just telling us that the proper factorization scale is much lower than we would have guessed. It's not right at M at the Higgs mass. It's somewhat below, and they choose a value which is roughly a quarter of the Higgs mass is what they advocate as the proper factorization scale. And it's based on exactly the same argument that that at low the T-channel pull, it should this cross-section should scale as 1 over T. And where it falls off doesn't mean that the factorization has failed. It means that's the correct factorization point. Now, all of this can be resolved if you just take a full look at the power counting of alpha s and the logarithmic terms that are being included here. Okay, the PDFs implicitly include this tower of alpha times log in them. So BB bar annihilation, the leading order term, is not of order 1. It's of order alpha squared log squared, because the gluons had to split to produce that PDF. So this is what would you get from the leading order BB bar annihilation. Just this one piece here. You've got the tower of logs, and it starts at alpha squared log squared. The next leading order term in this picture would be here. It's down by 1 power of the log because it has both virtual corrections and real corrections, which do not produce an extra logarithm. This term comes with the next leading order calculation and is the first term to include all of the alpha squared terms and all the logarithmic enhancements. Okay. Further terms in cubed LO and beyond are strictly alpha s suppressed, and alpha s corrections. All the logarithmic terms have been incorporated, and by the time you get to NNLO, all of the alpha squared terms that you started with have been incorporated. So Harland and I did this NNLO calculation. Since all the collinear logs are resummed and included, we can ignore the B mass completely. We just do, except at the Yukawa coupling, and we just do this calculation. And here's the result. Green curve is the leading order with a very large scale dependence. The next leading order is this blue curve. Much better, but still fairly large scale dependence. And the NNLO result has a very small scale dependence. by coincidence or not, this is Willenbrock and company's calculation. This is mu of quarter of mh. It pretty much crosses the NNLO line at that point. So I'm not a great fan of scale setting myself, but nonetheless, the argument works beautifully in this particular example. And here is the actual cross-section. You can see at 10 beta equals 1, this is completely unimportant, totally dominated by gluon fusion. By 10 beta of 7, this mode dominates for all masses of the, all relevant masses of the Higgs. The crossover point is at 10 beta of 7. In a single, where you have a single tagged B, the final state, you start with the starting process in the variable flavor scheme is B plus gluon goes to B plus Higgs. For this process, the power counting tells you that next deleting order is sufficient to get all of the to incorporate all of the powers of the correct powers of alpha S in the log, and that all further corrections are just alpha S corrections, not log corrections. Okay, so you expect this to be a very reliable result. That's exactly what you find. Once again, this magic scale, the leading correction agrees very well with the next leading correction. but you see that the next leading correction done in this way is very flat in scale. Recently, or very soon, will be reported results for GG goes to BB bar H at next deleting order. The double tag mode has been published by both of these groups. The semi and totally inclusive modes are will be published soon. so this calculation is out to alpha S cubed, which is one order higher than the two variable flavor scheme calculations I showed you. But it doesn't resum the logs. So it gets each order produces a new log of MB, and so it doesn't, so it's not, so it's, you expect it to be less, to have more scale dependence because of this unresummed logarithms. But it's very flexible in that you can use it, you can perform the calculations and compare it to the variable flavor schemes. So this is with two tagged B quarks. You just see it's fairly well behaved. It's not a terribly large correction in either direction. And it has much better scale dependence than the leading order result. Okay, this is for whether, I think the red curves use MS bar mass and the blue curves use the on-shell mass. That's an interesting discussion in itself as to why they differ so much. But both show that you get very good scale dependence, much better than the leading order. You compare it to the inclusive cross-section, you see actually they overlap for low Higgs mass, though the uncertainty band is much wider, and they're a little smaller for larger Higgs masses. The uncertainty band doesn't narrow very much for this process, whereas it gets quite a bit narrower for the BB bar annihilation. So this is the scale dependence of the gluon, glue goes to BB bar H. And you can see the huge scale dependence of the leading order result, much better behavior for the next leading order result. And now I'm going to overlay the result from BB bar annihilation. You see, it's again huge, and it just happens to go in the opposite direction, leading to this spurious large discrepancy. Whereas this is the NNLO result, very flat. It's significantly larger, somewhat larger, than the NLO result in the fixed flavors calculation. But both are pretty well behaved. And you expect it to be enhanced because this has the resummed logs. It has the log-enhanced terms taken into account to all order. But it's not a huge number. It's not a factor 10, which people worried about when they had leading order calculations to compare. The single tagged mode, you see it's actually a very significant enhancement, more of the order of 40%. The inclusive mode was not nearly such a large enhancement. and I don't have a plot for comparing the uncertainty, but you know that the B parton, I'm done, next to last slide. The B parton result was very flat, and this one, as with the others, has some residual scale dependence. So there's been great progress in understanding what was going on with this picture, why you seem to get a large discrepancy between the two approaches. I think that's largely gone away, and you can actually see that, well, part of the problem was that people were using just, were ignoring the gluon fusion component, or the gluon initial state component, and just using BB bar annihilation at very low order. And that's very naive, because these B quarks did come from the gluons, and you only get a really consistent result when you include the parent process, the one you would use in a fixed flavor scheme. But when you do include that, you get a very well-behaved result. You properly resum all the logs, and it agrees well with higher order calculations in this fixed flavor scheme, as it should. Okay? So there really is no problem in the sense that variable flavor scheme always did work fairly well. It was theoretically sound, and it was just you were comparing two unreliable low-order calculations. When you calculate to far at a high enough order to get a reliable result, the results compare very nicely, and the situation seems much clearer. Thank you.
What is now the uncertainty in the glue to BB bar Higgs in terms of percent, the remaining uncertainty?
Yes, I should say, the fact that I have these plots at all is due more to the fact that I'm down the hall from Sally than anyone else, because these are not, these are preliminary results. I think I wrote that on several slides. Right, if you want to look at my slide and get out a ruler, you can probably calculate what it is. But okay. The lowest order is alpha squared log squared.
And the argument is that you have to first of all produce a B quark from gluon, right?
That's right.
Right. But isn't this the very essence of the variable scheme that this statement depends, of course, on the scale, right?
Yes. Right. So
you can't say that in general.
This should really be the factorization scale, but the process I'm interested in, the factorization scale is of the order of, within a factor of 10, 4, whatever,
okay,
of the Higgs mass. Yes, these formally should be the factorization scale, not the Higgs mass. I used the fact that the process I'm interested in has something to do with the Higgs mass.
Once
you go to high enough order, the factorization scale is largely drops out of the problem. You're producing a heavy object. You expect it to be something of the order of the Higgs mass, but you don't have to be very close to the Higgs mass to get essentially the right number if you've computed to high enough order. And that, I think the calculation demonstrates that. It's right. It's log mu squared. There's coefficient. You can absorb that other log, the log of the scale to the Higgs mass into the coefficient. That's right. It's a little.
I think this good discussion over coffee. So let's just thank all the speakers of this morning session.